I'm Thorne Dreyer, and this is Rag Radio. If you're not familiar, Rag Radio comes your way every Friday afternoon from 2 to 3 p.m., broadcast live on KOOP 91.7 FM, solar-powered, all-volunteer, cooperatively run community radio station in Austin, Texas. The show is rebroadcast by several other stations around the country, and the podcasts are put up at the Internet Archive at theragblog.com and at Veterans Today. And the podcasts have legs, as it were, as they say. Tracy Schultz is my engineer. Tracy, how are you doing, sir?
Doing well.
You ready to go out into the stars?
Sure.
While keeping your feet on the ground?
Yes. What is that, Casey Kasem? Yeah, sure.
Okay, sure. Sure, why not? Roger Baker's here taking pictures. We've got a great show in store for you today. This is going to be very special. We're going to be searching for extraterrestrial life right here on Rag Radio. My guest, prominent American astronomer Neil Evans, one of the greats in the field, one of the most influential in the field, and a pioneer. And also joining us is Austin astronomer and our dear friend Cecilia Colomé. We're going to be searching for existential life with Neil Evans, who is a UT Austin professor emeritus. Joining us in the discussion is Cecilia. Evans, who has served as a mentor to younger generations of astronomers, is a recognized pioneer in the study of how stars form in our galaxy and how planets form around them. The quest for extraterrestrial life primarily involves searching for stars that are somewhat similar to ours and planets that might have conditions close to those on Earth. Correct? Is that accurate?
That's at least a good starting point.
Dr. Evans earned his bachelor's degree and doctorate in physics at the University of California, Berkeley, and did a year and a half of postdoctoral work at Caltech before coming to Texas. Although initially interested in high energy and particle physics, he shifted his focus to astrophysics and worked with a research group started at Berkeley by Nobel laureate Charles Townes. Evans joined the University of Texas faculty in 1975, where he taught for 40 years, including classes about the search for extraterrestrial life and a seminar on the origin of the universe and life. He was the Randall Centennial Professor of Astronomy before becoming an emeritus professor in 2016. He has led large groups and programs on both the Spitzer and Herschel Space Telescope, studying the formation of stars and planet-forming disks. He is a member of the ALMA, A-L-M-A, board. ALMA is the world's largest radio observatory. Cecilia Colomé has a bachelor's degree in physics from the National Autonomous University of Mexico and a PhD in astronomy from the University of Texas at Austin. As a graduate student, Cecilia took several courses taught by Dr. Neil Evans, and she and Dr. Evans carried out numerous infrared observations on board NASA's Kuiper. And I think somebody just said that a minute ago. Airborne Observatory and at McDonald Observatory in West Texas. Cecilia currently works in Austin as an editor of math and science textbooks. Before we go any further, so you guys work together, and that's, I think, interesting because Cecilia is we have the teacher and the student here with us today. What did y'all do? What kind of research did you do before we get off into the bulk of our program here?
Well, Cecilia worked with me and Paul Harvey, another astronomer, and worked on instrumentation. So I was very happy to work with them because I don't build instruments, and so I'm always happy to be a parasite and use instruments that other people build. And so she had worked on something that could fly on the Kuiper Airborne Observatory, and I think she probably has more vivid recollections of that experience than I do.
Cecilia, your vivid recollections, please.
We were frequent flyers on NASA's Kuiper Airborne Observatory, which was a C-141 airplane, huge airplane, where they cut a hole behind the cockpit, pressurized to put an infrared telescope. So in order to make infrared observations, we flew for about 8 hours around. And come back.
Go ahead, Dr. Evans.
No, that was fine. I think one of the interesting things about trying to observe out of an airplane is that the telescope pointed out one of the sides of the airplane. So you had to fly in a certain direction to observe a certain point in the sky. At the same time, you had to eventually, after 8 hours, get back to where you started before you ran out of fuel. So that meant that you had some interesting attempts to plan the objects you were going to look at and for how long, so that you managed to achieve all of this and still get back to Ames Research Center where the plane flew from.
Right, right. And especially hoping that there won't be a fire.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
Well, there was one, probably the pilots were already experienced that if an engine caught fire, they just dive in, you know, down to earth, the airplane to extinguish the fire. It was an old airplane, so things happen.
Yeah, but that wasn't even the first fire, I think, that had happened there. So, science. I read Neil that somewhere a former student of yours complaining a little bit in a kind of tongue in cheek way. Because he thought when he enrolled in the course, he thought it was going to be about little green men, and that's not exactly what we're talking about. Although, you know, who knows, if we find intelligent life, it could be green. I also wanted to read something that you wrote as an introduction to an essay, because I think it's interesting. You said, "Are we alone? Along with questions about black holes, this is one of the questions most commonly asked of astrophysicists. While the simple answer is that we don't know, logical and rational experience of the question can be illuminating, and exploration of the question can be illuminating and a very good way to introduce non-scientists to the scientific worldview." So are we going to be introduced here? Is our RAG radio audience going to be introduced to the scientific worldview?
We're going to do our best.
Okay. I think this is fascinating, and it's something that I know a little about, but not much, and certainly not in any detail. And I don't know what people out there, I'm sure we have a wide variety of people in the audience, and they have various levels of knowledge. But I think, let me ask you this. I've said who you are. Tell us a little bit more about you and the work you've done and the areas of research that you've specialized in.
So I work on the formation of stars and planets, and this whole field has developed a lot during the time that I've worked on it, and we know a lot more about it, but there's still a lot of mysteries. And because this happens in giant clouds of gas and dust, it's essentially hidden from our view if we just looked with visible light. So we do most of our work using infrared and radio waves, and so we use these large radio telescopes like the ALMA, which is an array of radio telescopes in a very high plateau in Chile. We use to get some of the wavelengths in the infrared that absolutely don't get through the atmosphere, we have to put telescopes in space. So that was the Spitzer Space Telescope and later the Herschel Space Telescope. Herschel was a European project. But we use those a lot to study the details of the process. And it becomes into play in thinking about extraterrestrial life because you need to know if planets form around other stars and what kind of materials they have, because we are made out of certain materials, and those materials have to be present for life to arise in another planetary system.
Or we assume. Assuming that life, that it's what, a carbon-based life form, or that there isn't some other kind of life that we can't anticipate? Is that...
That is one of the classic issues that comes up in this in discussion of this question. And, of course, you're right, we don't know for sure. On the other hand, when we look at the chemistry in space, and we now know there's almost 200 molecules that are known in interstellar space. And if you look at that chemistry, it's carbon chemistry,
okay,
just like the chemistry of life on Earth. And there's a lot of other reasons why you would think it's pretty likely that life on another planet will be based on carbon. The molecules, that is, will be, you know, carbon linked together with other things, but basically built on carbon structures. And there's reasons also to think that you need liquid water. And that's the kinds of things that we consider when we think about what makes a planet suitable for life.
Okay. What else is that? What else in terms of the research that you do? I mean.
So isn't that enough?
Isn't that no? No. I want to be sure that you've always kept busy.
That's taken me 40 years just to get that.
Okay,
far,
that's so. pretty much
that's
how the work
much
is
what
done.
We try to work on. Yeah.
Okay. How? What kind of classes have you taught?
Well, I teach. I've taught everything from graduate classes on how radiation and matter interact, very technical stuff, down to that seminar you mentioned, which was in the Plan 2 program at UT. So very selected, very bright students, no more than about 15 in a class, and all conducted through seminars and discussion. And we took a kind of historical approach to our pictures of how our picture of the universe has changed and then how our understanding of that has changed in the modern age. But we go all the way back to the ancient Greeks. And then we did the same thing for our conception of life and talked about those issues. And that, of course, gets you into the boundary between science, philosophy, and religion. So we deal with that kind of thing in that class.
Well, that's something that I read said that you frequently teach a seminar that compares ideas about origins drawn from philosophy, religion, history, and science, exploring the different perspectives that each field of inquiry contributes. And that before settling into physics, you were an English major.
Well, I was never quite an English major. Well, I was kind of what you call a crypto English major. I was a physics major, but I kept taking English major classes for fun.
So knowledge is interdisciplinary, right?
I think when I started to teach that Plan 2 class, it was sort of going back to my roots of being interested in both humanities and science and trying to bridge the gap.
Okay. Cecilia, do you have, before we move on?
What kind of students enroll in that kind of course, the search for extraterrestrial life?
So the search for extraterrestrial life is a different class. That's a big class. It's a big class for non-majors. Typically, it'd have about 150 students. And they're everything from people saying, I need a science course, I'm just going to take this one, it sounds like fun, to people that have, a particular interest in the subject. So it's a big range. And I always got some subset of the students were UFO fans, and so I had to tell them right away at the first that I was not a believer in UFOs as extraterrestrial visitors, and this wasn't going to be a class about little green men. So
you're not a believer, but do you discount the possibility?
I don't think that the various phenomena that come under the heading of unidentified flying objects. I think it's extremely implausible that it has anything to do with extraterrestrial life. Let me put it that way.
Okay, no flying saucers.
Well, if they're flying, they may be flying saucers, but they're probably government projects.
There you go. It's all a big conspiracy, isn't it? It's interesting to me what kind of people are attracted to this sort of search, and I imagine it's people more than, or this kind of research, this kind of, and I'm sure it's more than people who are just interested in the basic mathematics and physics involved in the process. Is it people, do you find that this, what do you find about those students?
Well, like I said, there's all kinds. I mean, with a class of 150 students, you get all kinds. Some who are very into it, very excited. They do a lot of research and come to you and talk about it. And then others are just trying to get by. That's the reality of teaching a big class at the big university.
Is it mostly lecture?
It's lecture. And then in recent years, it's been one of these things called a signature class, which means we get three TAs for 150 students, and each TA meets with three sections, so every Friday the students have a more in-depth experience working with the TA and doing exercises, and that dramatically improved their understanding of the course.
You didn't start out with an interest essentially in astrophysics, did you? I mean, how did you move to the kind of things that you teach now or that you have been teaching? Do you still teach?
I just retired in September, so I no longer teach.
I didn't know if you still taught some.
I could. I mean, the basic deal in university is you get paid for teaching. So I don't get paid and I don't teach, but I could be interested in teaching certain Plan 2 classes for fun.
Do they let you keep an office?
I keep an office, yeah. I'm going to have to move to a smaller office next year. But
so what got you interested in this specific field?
You know, I came to astronomy through physics, and a lot of it had to do with the fact that the physics experiments I worked on as an undergraduate were already getting quite expensive, and they were getting to be big teams, and I wanted to do something that wasn't quite so anonymous. And so I found out that this Nobel Prize winner, Charlie Townes, had come to Berkeley, and he was starting an astrophysics group. And I went and talked to him, and when I look back now, I think, boy, that was a pretty nervy thing for an undergrad just to walk up to a Nobel Prize winner and say, could I do some work with you? And but anyway, he was very gracious, and as he always was, and he gave me something to work on, and I decided to go to grad school and work with him, and so that's how I made that switch.
Cool. Dr. Colomé, what got you interested, as long as we're talking about how we get into, so what got you interested in this, in astronomy?
My path sounds similar to Neil. I studied physics. I liked everything, and particularly science, so it was very, very hard to narrow it down. But one of my teachers told me that if I was interested in science, I should go to the basic, which is physics. And that's what I did. And in college, taking my physics courses, I took an elective course with Manuel Peinbert, a wonderful Mexican astronomer. And that really just, you know, I never thought of astronomy, I mean, becoming an astronomer, but that course really changed me. So my interest grew from that. And so at that time, there was no astronomy degree in Mexico when I was an undergraduate. So I finished my undergraduate in physics and then started working with an astronomer, but doing graduate school in physics, which was double work. And at some point, I decided to apply for graduate school outside of Mexico, and that's how I got to UT into the astronomy program.
Okay, Tracy, this might be a good time to take a break. We're talking with Dr. Neil Evans and Dr. Cecilia Colomé about, among other things, the search for extraterrestrial. We have to search for terrestrial life first. I think there's some, at least sentient. But we'll be right back after this. Tracy Shields.
There's a snowman waiting in the sky. He'd like to come and meet us, but he thinks he'd blow our minds. There's a snowman waiting in the sky. He's told us not to blow it, cause he knows it's all worthwhile. He told me, let the children lose it, let the children use it, let all the children do get.
Okay, I'm Thorne Dreyer. This is Rag Radio. We're back with Neil Evans and Cecilia Colomé. Tracy, what were we just listening to there?
Oh, something classic, as recommended by our guest, Starman by David Bowie, of course. Very apropos.
You think? Very cool. All right, we've been talking. Neil Evans is a preeminent American astronomer. Cecilia Colomé, who's joining us in the discussion, is an astronomer and also wears several other hats, although she doesn't seem to be wearing a hat today. So, when you start this kind of search, what are the factors, what are the things you look at?
Okay, so what I do in the class is take the students through something called the Drake equation.
Okay.
Yeah, I said equation, but don't be frightened. It's not a big deal. But this wonderful radio astronomer named Frank Drake about 50, 60 years ago wrote down on a blackboard this equation. And it purports to tell you how many civilizations there are in our galaxy that we could communicate with. And it's a very nice way of organizing our thinking about this. And if equation makes you nervous, you can think about a kind of an analogy that's sometimes used. It's the search for the perfect restaurant. So here we are in Austin, Texas, and you know, there's now a lot of restaurants, but let's suppose that we have some restrictions. We need a restaurant that's open when we want to go, that has a reservation when we can get in. One of our parties is vegan, so we got to have that kind of thing, and so forth. And so that's the kind of process you start narrowing down, you know, from an initial big selection until you find out which, does it have all the properties that we need?
So what are some of the things when you're looking for life, when you're looking at other planets, what are the some of the things that you actually, you're not looking for a restaurant unless it's the sort of, you know, interstellar cafeteria.
Right.
What are some of the things that you start, that you actually look at?
So the first thing we would start, just the equivalent of is there a restaurant, is you need a star. So it's generally believed, there are a few people who don't, but let's take the main path here, that you need a star. Our sun provides the energy that keeps the life on Earth going, with some exceptions again. But generally speaking, we think we need a star. So how many stars are there in the Milky Way galaxy? And the answer is, I just looked up the latest review, there's about 100 billion stars in the Milky Way galaxy. So no shortage of restaurants. However, you need more than a star. We don't live on the sun. We live on a star that circles, so we live on a planet that circles the sun. So you need a planet. And until recently, we really had no idea whether most stars had planets or not. In the last few decades, we have been finding more and more evidence for planets around other stars. And the latest count that I looked up just before coming is at least 3,500 known planets around other stars. Now, these planets are hard to find. 3,500 sounds like a lot smaller than 100 billion, but it's because they're very rare. They're very hard to find, I should say. And so if you take into account how hard to find they are, the best estimates are that at least a half of all stars have planetary systems. So that's a good thing. So if you start with 100 billion and you only cut out half of them, you still got 50 billion possibilities for your host planet or your restaurant.
We're counting out the possibility that there could be star dwellers.
we are.
Okay.
We're leaving out some oddball possibilities that might happen. We're kind of taking the mainstream approach.
Okay.
We're looking for life that's not totally different from us for reasons we'll get to.
Right.
Okay, so let's we got planets, lots of planets. Now, there are a lot of planets in our solar system, but they would not be suitable for life. As far as we know, the Earth is the only planet in our solar system that has life. There's still some possibilities out there. Maybe Mars, maybe a moon of Jupiter called Europa, things like that. They're possible, but we don't know. So generally speaking, again, following the main path, we want a planet that's sort of Earth-like. Now, the problem is that if we look for planets around other stars, the easiest ones to see are big planets that are close to the star. Planets as big as small as Earth are very hard to see. We now know of about 25 of these that are no more than about twice the mass of the Earth, so kind of Earth-like. But again, those are the hardest ones to find. So again, if people try to correct for that, the general calculations I've seen suggest that there should be a planet, we'll call it a habitable planet, kind of Earth-like planet, around in most planetary systems. So if we can, that's a huge extrapolation, we don't know. We're going to know a lot more about that in the next 5 years or so. But right now, that's a reasonable guess to say that for every planetary system, there's maybe one planet suitable for life.
Okay. Cecilia, do you want to add anything to this or ask any questions about it?
A question about how do scientists take into account the timing issue? I mean, one thing is that, you know, how likely it is that life formed outside our solar system, and the other issue is, do we coincide in the history of the galaxy? And because of that, if we don't coincide, we will never know, because we are not coexisting in time.
That was something I wanted to talk about, but not quite yet.
Okay, we'll wait.
Okay. Before you move on with it, we say Earth-like.
Yep.
And we say a star that seems like it would have... What actually are the factors that we think come into play to make something conceivably habitable?
Okay, so now...
A place where life could generate.
That's right. That's a good question for right now, because I just said, you know, habitable Earth-like planet. But what does that mean? Nope. So we need a star that's not too different from the sun. And the reason is that if you make a star twice as massive as the sun, it doesn't live long enough for any kind of complex life to evolve. So you throw out all the more massive stars. Stars come in a whole range of masses. The less massive stars, for which there are a lot, have other issues, but they may in fact be the primary places where life might exist. So there's a lot of back and forth about that, but right now people tend to keep those low mass stars but throw out the high mass stars. So in terms of suitability, we still keep almost all stars, because most stars are low mass.
Okay. So which is a special area of yours, an area of specialty, was it, right? In low mass stars?
Sort of. But more in the formation.
Formation.
You know? So now what we studied was, when the stars form, do they form with a disk of stuff around them? And that disk is what planets form out of. Our solar system was formed out of a rotating disk of gas and dust. And we're studying the properties of those things to see if they are suitable for forming planets. And that's a big question right now. We're working on that.
Right. Well, the conditions that we assume make something habitable, make a planet habitable, and we think there's an extreme beyond which, I guess, in various ways, heat, I don't know what factors, that it wouldn't be explained. What is the likelihood that that life would evolve or develop in a place that we right now think it couldn't? Which is sort of like the earlier question, and maybe this is off topic for you right now.
No, we're basically there. So. As I said earlier, we think you need some kind of liquid, and generally speaking, liquid water is the most likely one, though other possibilities exist. So to have liquid water, you need to be the right distance from the star. Essentially, if you're too close, the water all becomes gas, and if you're too far away, it all becomes ice. And so you need to be in this range called the habitable zone, or sometimes called the Goldilocks zone, of distances around the star. So that's one of the things that people are trying to find out as they study more intently these other planetary systems, is how many planets are in this Goldilocks zone. Now, that's just the minimum. You got to have liquid water. But you also have to have carbon-rich compounds that we think came to the Earth through collisions of comets and asteroids after the Earth formed. So we study whether those exist in these disks around forming stars to see if the conditions are going to be right in the majority of cases for those carbon-rich compounds to reach a newly formed planet. So that's kind of what my research is interested in right now.
Okay. Cecilia? Oh, no? I'm also interested in how you do those searches. You know, what is the process? Is that something you want to wait? I mean, does that fit in now?
Yeah, we can fit that in now.
Okay.
So
is it all light and math?
Light and math. Yeah, that's pretty much it. So you know, if you expand your concept of light to include any kind of electromagnetic radiation, like right. infrared and radio, that's all. They're all the same thing as light. So we study these regions that are forming stars, and we look at the properties of the gas and dust in these disks around the stars. And I have a student right now that's working on a calculation of what happens to the molecules in those things. And we find that a lot of the carbon winds up in what we call complex organic molecules. These are not complex from a biologist's point of view, but they're complex from an astronomer's point of view. And so they wind up in ices, and so then those are available after you form planets to come crashing in as comets or asteroids and provide that material, that icy material, to the planet's surface. One way to think about it is, you know, the planets are made out of a huge number of originally microscopic dust particles that have stuck together. This Earth was originally a whole bunch of tiny microscopic dust particles. And all the life on it, the ocean, the atmosphere, and everything, was icy material on some of those dust particles. And so you have to see how that assembles to imagine a planet like the Earth. So that's kind of what we're interested in right now in terms of research.
And I don't want to get too much into the weeds, but I'm interested in what you're searching, exactly what you're looking at. I mean, are you looking at shadows a lot? What are you looking for when you do that search that's going to teach you these things?
So one of the things, for example, we can do with the ALMA telescopes in Chile is to look at what are called spectral lines. Each of these molecules has a particular fingerprint. It emits radio waves at very precisely known frequencies. So by looking carefully at the spectrum of one of these disks around a forming star, we can deduce whether or not certain molecules are there. And so that's what one of the ways that we find out what are the properties and the conditions in these planet-forming regions.
Okay. The advanced telescopes, the technology as it continues to become more more complex and to make, you know, to give you more. I mean, how much of a difference has that made? How much have you been able to learn more in recent times than in the past? And what are you looking forward to? That's a sort of a vague question, but I'm talking mainly about telescopes.
Yeah, well, like I said, when I started teaching this class, this factor that we talk about, the fraction of stars with planets, was completely unknown. Uh-huh. The solar system could have been unique for all we knew. Because of various telescopes that have developed and instruments on those telescopes, we now know that's not the case. And we know that planets are common. So that's the biggest advance that's happened in this field since the time I started teaching the class. The ALMA is the most interesting telescope right now for this kind of study, but very soon, in a couple of years, the James Webb Space Telescope will launch. And this is the one that has the mirrors that will unfold, hopefully, properly, in space, and will give us an incredible tool for studying the infrared. Now, the infrared has the advantage that it can detect molecules that are actually frozen on the ice. Once they're frozen on the ice, they can't radiate radio waves, but they can still radiate or absorb infrared light. And so that will provide a new tool for studying the properties of these disks.
And what are we looking for after that? I mean, and what do we think these new technologies will allow us to perhaps see and learn that we have no idea about right now? Obviously, if we have no idea, it's hard to answer that question. But, you know, what are the possibilities?
So, of course, the telescope does many things besides what I just talked about.
Right.
But the most, for me, the most interesting thing will be to try to study the decompositions of these disks. We did some of that with the Spitzer Space Telescope. But the JWST will be quite a bit more powerful. Its mirror is 8 times bigger than the Spitzer.
Size matters. Okay. What else? What haven't we touched on in this area?
I think that's the main things about habitability. And now maybe we can move on to the question you asked a little bit ago, which is, suppose you have a habitable planet.
Right.
Suppose you've got liquid water. Suppose you've got carbon-rich molecules. Do you get life? That is probably the weakest link in the scientific story, because life is incredibly complex. Even the simplest virus is much more complex than any of the molecules that we know about that come in on, say, comets or asteroids or that we find in meteorites. So how did life become, how did these molecules become complex enough to cross the threshold from non-living to living? There's been some very interesting recent results in lab simulations that show promise, but I think it's still the biggest unknown. It could be that there's lots of planets suitable for life in our galaxy, but life only arose on our planet. Right. That's, we can't rule that out until we know there's life somewhere else. So that's why it's so interesting to look for life or even fossil life on Mars or anywhere else in our solar system. If we knew that there was more than one place where life arose, we would know that that fraction is not small.
Because wasn't there a lot of chance involved in it happening here? I mean, a lot of factors kind of had to come together in certain ways.
Well, that
even if the potential was there.
Yeah. That is the question. I mean, if you do a simple probability calculation of getting a certain molecule out of the various parts that we know would be available, it looks, you know, very improbable. But we just don't know enough to know how many molecules are interesting. How many, you know, you don't have to get one. Maybe there's you know, millions or billions that are interesting and will lead to life. So it's one of these things that is basically not known right now, is how commonly life will arise on a planet where it has the right conditions. So that's our first big unknown.
Okay. That's our unknown unknown.
Yeah.
Our known unknown.
It's known,
that's
yeah.
Our known unknown. Yeah. Okay, we're going to take another break. I'm Thorne Dreyer. This is RAG Radio, and we're talking with Dr. Neil Evans and Dr. Cecilia Colomé. Tracy? Johnny B. Goode.
Yeah. It's remembered that the infamous golden disc from the Voyager satellite. It's like one of the songs that were on it, amongst other things, was Johnny B. Goode by Chuck Berry. And it reminded me of a funny Steve Martin bit at the time where he said something to the effect that we've heard back from outer space. And it was a simple message. It just said, send more Chuck Berry.
Everything's connected, isn't it? That was Tracy Schultz. I'm Thorne Dreyer. We're back with Dr. Neil J. Evans and Dr. Cecilia Colomé. We're talking about the search for extraterrestrial life and larger questions therein. Okay, we're moving to the next step. Cecilia, why don't you take us there?
Yes, I have a question, Neil, and it is related to this experiments that people have been able to repeat in the laboratory and connected to the emergence of life on Earth. And as I've heard since back in the 80s that when ultraviolet light strikes on clay material, certain amino acids, which are the building block of life, arise. There's some kind of chemical reaction that from which very complex life building blocks are formed. Do you have an update about that?
Yeah, there's been a lot of experiments of that type, and certain clays are very good at catalyzing chemical reactions. That is, they will help a reaction proceed. So for example, amino acids on the clay will tend to form peptide bonds, which is how you get from amino acids to proteins. So that is certainly one of the routes that people have talked about for getting building up complexity. Basically, we have to take these simple starting points and figure out how they build up to complex things like proteins and nucleic acids that can begin to the process of life.
Okay. Okay, we're talking about the various factors here as we unfold. What else?
So suppose we get life. We'd like to have life that we could communicate with and life that could send us a signal. So we need more than microbes. And if you look at the history of life on Earth,
we need something sentient.
Life probably arose on the Earth about 3.5 billion years ago, but it was only microscopic life until about 500 million years ago. So that means that most of the history of the Earth was simply microbial. And interesting as that is, it's not going to send any messages. So we need human-level intelligence, let's call it. It's just intelligence at the level of humans to make the next step. And we understand the process that causes that. It's called evolution. And so evolution proceeded and produced a great diversity of life on the Earth. And some parts of that diversity included rather intelligent species and finally leading to humans. Will it always lead to intelligence? We don't know that question. We don't know the answer to that.
Before you even ask that, is evolution always going to be at play?
Evolution will always be at play.
Does that seem like that's part of the natural process?
Okay. As long as you have life that's based on replicating molecules and you have mutations and selection, evolution will be at play.
Okay.
Now, one of the interesting things here now is the time scale, because it took about 3 billion years, maybe 4 billion years, for life on Earth to develop intelligence. The galaxy is only 10 billion years old. So we're talking about now numbers that are a substantial fraction of the life of the galaxy. So suppose we were really fast. We would be then the first intelligent life forms in the galaxy. Or on the other hand, were we really slow? Why did it take so long for complicated life to arise? Then there would be lots of other intelligent species out there in the galaxy. So that's one of the interesting questions that we don't have an answer to.
Okay. What else is involved?
Okay, so we got intelligent life. Now, some people might say, well, dolphins are pretty intelligent too, and that might encourage us that intelligence is likely to arise.
Do we need intelligence with opposable thumbs?
Yeah, that's for the next step. Exactly right. Dolphins may be very intelligent, but they're not going to build radio telescopes.
Okay.
So you need a terrestrial land-living animal with the ability to use tools, and you need to develop technology. So here we are on a little firmer ground, because technology flows from science, which relies on written language. Written language always developed when there was agriculture. So what do we know about the development of agriculture in various civilizations on the Earth? The answer is that at least in 3, maybe 5 independent cases, agriculture arose. So that gives us some encouragement that this next step to develop technology would be common if you have intelligent species on a planet.
Do we assume then that an intelligent species on another planet would in many ways follow our model?
That's an interesting question, because we certainly don't think that evolution will produce anything that looks like humans.
Right.
Evolution doesn't work in that way. on the other hand, and this is the argument that leading evolutionary thinkers have had with each other, Stephen Jay Gould said it's very improbable you would get anything like human-level intelligence. Simon Conway Morris, who studied the origin of complex animals in the Burgess Shale, said, actually, I think if you replayed the tape, you would get something, wouldn't look like humans, but it would probably be bipedal, have opposable thumbs, and use tools. So you got two of the experts who disagree. And so nobody knows the answer.
Well, and also, might we not have dolphins of a sort, but that have certain sort of their brains are developed in a certain way that they can create stuff not using our traditional way of doing it?
Okay, now you're getting into technology. Now you're getting into woo-woo stuff.
Am I getting into metaphysics?
So they may be able to communicate in some way, but they're not going to communicate across interstellar distances. So if our interest is in extraterrestrial life and communication, we do need technology.
Okay, end of woo-woo segment.
Okay.
Okay, so then what's the next step?
So the next step, suppose you get a technological civilization somewhere in the galaxy. The next question is, how long does it last? Because, and that's kind of like, we had our search for the perfect restaurant, we got it narrowed down, and now we ask a different question. Does our friend come into the same restaurant that we do without knowing that we're there? And the probability of that goes up the longer we sit in that restaurant, right? Uh-huh. So the longer we last, right, the bigger the chance there'll be another civilization that we could communicate with. So how long are we going to last? Well, the fundamental limitation is, and it's not even the absolute limitation, is how long is our star going to last? And that's about another 5 billion years. 5 billion with a B. However, the sun keeps getting more and more luminous, so it's going to get warmer on the Earth, and even without current global warming. And in about a billion years, the oceans will evaporate. So the Earth will become uninhabitable in about a billion years. If we could last a billion years, and if that's typical, if most civilizations last a billion years, then, and all the other factors are close to one, then there are a lot of civilizations in the galaxy we could communicate with. But do you think we're going to last a billion years?
I mean, the chances that we're going to destroy our own habitable planet seem to be too great to think that.
Yeah, we probably won't destroy the planet.
Or our habitable aspect.
We might undo the biosphere, and we could certainly destroy our technological civilization with various stupid things that we could do. And so
we might return to some kind of primitive life.
Right. one of the fun things for the students in the class, they have to estimate all of these factors, and the most intriguing one for them to work on is how long is a civilization going to last? Because they have to think about all the different ways that civilizations can destroy themselves or get destroyed. We could get hit by an asteroid hitting the Earth, things like that, as well as all the human-caused disasters that we could think of.
Okay. So then you're talking about all the projections that have to be done, and there's where we, I guess, really get into mathematics and probability, things like that. So what's, and I don't know how we exactly, I don't know where what point we're at and where we kind of sum this, up. But.
So the way this works in the class is every student makes an estimate for each of these factors and then calculates the number of civilizations and then thinks about what that means. Now, if your listeners are interested in doing that for themselves with their own guesses for all these factors, they can just Google Drake Equation Calculator, and the one that will pop up is the one that we built on the University of Texas site.
Cool.
So you can go to that, and you can play, change the factors and see what happens. Now, if there's a lot of civilizations, the distance between them is small. And so you can calculate also how far away is the nearest civilization, given your number. Everybody knows that we don't know these numbers, but you can play the game. And then you can think about how you would communicate. And the way that most work has been done is through radio waves. And so we have these giant radio dishes, and we can use those to listen for signals from other civilizations. And some of that has gone on, but it's been very spotty. It hasn't had a lot of money. Very recently, just a couple of years ago, a few high-tech billionaires decided to contribute $100 million to this effort. And they are essentially buying time on some of the big radio telescopes in the world to do a very sophisticated search, much more thorough than has been done before, for radio signals from other civilizations. So I think that's a very interesting development that who knows if it'll succeed, but at least it's going to be a credible effort.
Okay. Is that so? Cecilia, do you have anything to add or ask in relation to?
I have a question. When you teach that course, and when you have taught that course, the search for extraterrestrial life, is there any particular topic, I mean, part of the topic, that surprises the student the most?
Oh, interesting.
Or...
I probably have to ask the students that. But
I
think the biggest thing that students of astronomy have to come to grips with is just how big things are and how far apart things are. For example, you might ask the question, we have to worry about other civilizations sending things here, which gets back to the UFO problem. So I'll explain why I don't think UFOs have anything to do with extraterrestrial visitors. The nearest star is about 4 light years away. The fastest thing we've made would take about 100,000 years to get there. It's extremely expensive and difficult to travel between stars. So the idea that there's lots of visitors to the Earth kind of flying around and crash landing in swamps in Louisiana and so forth is not very plausible.
Unless, of course, they found woo-woo ways to travel.
Yeah, even with woo-woo ways,
it's still going to be a trip.
Still, you know, you have to have a really good reason. And the only reason I can think of is that your star is getting too hot for comfort. In that case, I don't think they're going to be messing around.
No,
they would be a highly advanced civilization way beyond us, and they're not going to crash land.
Oh, you mean the fact that the sun is getting that hot means they are, that they have been around for a long time.
They would be around a long time, and they would, just the fact that they could travel through space and get here means that they have to be very advanced, and they would not come here unless they had a good reason, and the only reason I can think of is that they wanted to take over.
Okay, we have about 4 minutes left. Do you want to sum up or top that off with anything? Otherwise, I have a couple of things I might ask.
No, so, go ahead.
Tell us about the high school in China.
Oh, right. So the last time I talked about this subject was I was in China in November doing a tour giving science talks to various institutes. But we wanted to go to Hangzhou because my host wanted to go there. And there was not a science institute there, but there was a high school for very advanced students. So we get to the high school in the morning, and all the students are out there to meet me at the gate. And very excited, very, you know, want to ask questions and so forth. But I kept hearing this buzzing sound. And I was thinking, what is this? Is this a giant insect or what? And finally, I looked up, and I see this drone that's flying up there filming the whole scene and controlled. And I realized, and I see somebody, one of the students is controlling this drone. So the whole thing was recorded by this drone. And it was quite an amazing experience.
Okay. As we drone on here.
Yes.
All right, one other thing. We have a change in regimes, as it were, in this country right now. And I guess my question is, what do you see as the future of research, of science, of how well it's going to be supported, whether you think a lot of funding will be taken away? You know, what some of the technology that you need to expand the work that you have done, you know, what? Give me a take.
Well, I think the problem with, and this applies to a lot of things about this incoming administration, is nobody knows. I mean, it's just so unpredictable. Certainly the appointment of an EPA administrator who's a climate science denier is not exactly encouraging, but we don't know what will happen with agencies like the NSF and NASA. It's just hard to predict.
You know, a lot of us would said before, well, who knows? He's such a loose cannon, and who knows what might happen, but one thing that we have seen is that there has been a consistency in terms of all of the appointments that he's made so far, or nominations, is that they are all very extreme, I think virtually without exception. So those of us who thought, well, maybe he'll end up being actually what he claimed to be, which is kind of a populist, and you know, as opposed to. So anyway, do you see cause for concern?
Yeah, there's always cause for concern when a new administration comes in, but. This one in particular, I think the unknowns are we really have the unknown unknowns in this case.
The unknown,
we have no idea what's going to happen here.
Okay. Yeah. Cecilia, would you like to say anything?
Yeah, very briefly. I imagine that many former students of Neil are listening to this show. I can think of one in particular that I know for sure is listening, and that's a very cool astronomer, James DeFrancesco in Victoria, British Columbia, Canada. Greetings from Austin, James.
Yes, that's great. And Tracy?
If I had like one question, it's like, you know, we've seen like the evolution of science fiction kind of impacting scientific studies. It's like Star Trek was very inspiring. Neil deGrasse Tyson was more realistic, but also inspiring. Do you see folks getting into the field now? It's like that are geared up for the minutiae. It's like the more the long game. It's like the that it takes. It's like for a field like this.
Yeah, I've just been going through 164 applicants for two faculty positions here in astronomy, and the abilities and talents of the young people out there are just astonishing. So I think that we have, and there's a lot of interest in outreach of the kind that Neil does too. So I think the future is very bright as long as we get money.
Okay, I want to thank, yes, money. Money's a big factor always, isn't it? Dr. Neil Evans, preeminent American astronomer. Dr. Cecilia Colomé, an Austin-based astronomer. Thank you both for being with us. I'm Thorne Dreyer. I wanted to say, we've got a few seconds, that we're... that the book that we did, Celebrating the Rag, that Alice Embry and Richard Croxdale and I will be appearing at Book People, speaking and signing books on January 5th, Thursday, January 5th at 7 p.m. So just to think about, something to mark on your calendars. I'm Thorne Dreyer. This is Rag Radio.